Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Patricia Marcos, and today I'm speaking with Professor Tita Shiku about her new book, The Experimental Imagination, Literary Knowledge and Science in the British Enlightenment, a book which is out by Stanford University Press and was published in 2018. So The Experimental Imagination is a book that very much invites the reader to reconsider the modern distinction we tend to hold between science and literature, and perhaps science and art more broadly, and which ultimately, in my opinion, ends up turning those distinctions on its head. So in that sense, it is a book that will interest anyone who is seeking to historicize and expand the meaning of scientific knowledge by way of recovering its early modern capaciousness, and in a way by using genre as a lens to unmoor the category science, from the very narrow and specialized confines that are permitted by the contemporary modern disciplines. So, in other words, it is a very rich book, both in terms of its analytical labor, as well as its methodology and the conceptual frameworks that are ultimately developed to advance its key arguments. And on a last note, this is also a book that I think will add a great deal to existing bodies of literature discussing topics like objectivity, truth, fact, early modern knowledge categories, among many other problems and disciplines. So I have no doubt that this book will become a regular presence in many classroom and many syllabi. Tita, welcome, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you very much, Patricia. It's a pleasure to be here and to speak with you about this. Thank you.
So the first question, as it is usual for the channel, is about you. We'd like to hear a little bit more about yourself, how you came to this field and to this specific project. And perhaps, if you don't mind, maybe you could share some of your personal reflections on the process of moving from your first book to your second project.
Okay, yes, thank you. So I am in an English literature department, as you said. So disciplinarily, my work is really focused on the question of literature. And my first book, it may not seem kind of topically, but methodologically is very similar to the work that has continued to animate my thinking. And that is really the relationship between some kind of context in literature, what that relationship is, in a sense, what is the distinctiveness of the literary in relationship to the historical record. And working in the 18th century has always required a deep engagement with historicism, whether it's called old historicism or new historicism. In a very powerful way, the texts themselves are so elusive. They insist upon their cultural moment that to begin to understand them, you really need to understand the culture more generally. So my first book, which I loved writing, and it came out of my dissertation, was thinking about the dressing room. And what I discovered is that its life in lived experience, its existence in very grand homes, was markedly different from its existence as a literary metaphor. And as I was writing that book, I came to develop this a kind of early interest in what science might do and mean. And it was thinking through epistemology and Swift's dressing room poems that I first came to think about how we come to know things. And that, of course, is a, you know, it's a grotesque and ridiculous satire about a young man going into his beloved's dressing room when she's not there and figuring out, oh, by the way, she's actually, her body is disgusting. So, you know, kind of it's surprise, surprise. And so it's a satire of experimental knowledge production because this is, you know, this young man is astounded and going in and discovering things that anyone, in a sense, with common sense would already know. So that was the answer. So the Swift chapter in my dressing room book was really thinking about epistemology. Once I finished that book, I had, you know, I had that moment that one never wants to have or wants to have. I found another text that was a dressing room that a young woman converted to a scientific laboratory.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yes. And I say I didn't want to have because I think if I had found this text much earlier, the dressing room book would have been very different. But that gave me a way to begin to think about what science was doing in places that you wouldn't expect. And, you know, as a historian of science, you know that it was practiced, you know, not exclusively in the kind of modern day laboratory context, but it was a domestic art, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we know that, but it gets lost. We forget that.
Right.
And so this particular play called The Basset Table has a young woman, Valeria, who, and this, she's a subplot of a larger play, but she finds a way to articulate her independence through the practice of science. And by, you know, trading her jewels for specimens, her beloved brings her a fly. She tries to convince her her cousin to give her her cousin's greyhound so she can dissect it. So there are a lot of ways in which this young woman is, she imagines herself differently. She imagines herself as an intellectual being. And I found that very illuminating to think about the, you know, the kind of very large change, scientific, you know, emergence of scientific thinking in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I kind of opened up to think on the one hand about places that science shows up in 18th century literary texts that might seem surprising,
right,
but also what kind of intellectual work those moments produce. And I have to say that simultaneously, I was, as I began getting into science and literature, I was very influenced by where the conversation was in 18th century studies. And that was really tied to the novel. That,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that empiricism really shaped the novel. And I published a number of articles really thinking about details and empiricism. But part of the writing process and the research process for me was realizing that I was much more concerned with science as a trope than an argument about the rise of the novel. So I ended up cleaving that part of the manuscript. And when I did that, the fullness of what became the experimental imagination really appeared.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. And I, you know, you engage very direct. When I started reading it, immediately I thought, okay, this would be maybe like a meal well paired with Barbara Shapiro's work, which was one of the first ones I had to read on in graduate school, The Social History of Fact, with Dastan and Gallison's Objectivity, but with Leviathan and the Air Pump. And you engage very directly with the idea of the with Leviathan and the Air Pump and the arguments they include, but also the argument, some things that they did not develop quite as fully, and which you as a literature scholar explore much more, and perhaps with much more comfort than Chapin and Schaffer would have. I found very interesting.
Th- thank you for that, because I find, you know, their work has really been so influential to me and so many other thinkers, as well as Shapiro and Destin and Galliston. And what really strikes me, coming from a career, as I say, in a literature department, is with Leviathan and Air Pump, the evocation of literary technologies, but without, to my mind, a kind of an appreciation for the fullness of what they actually accomplish. So virtual witnessing, I think, is a great concept, but it ends up, what I want to do is really show that to come up with this idea of virtual witnessing, you have to use it's a figuration, you have to use the imagination. So, right. You know, and then to turning that, it is a literary instrument, mm-hmm. but as we know, instruments require themselves a kind of theoretical thinking. There's the praxis, of course, but also right. the theoretical thinking. And I think that's what I hope and really want to contribute to the interdisciplinary conversation about what literature and science are doing in relationship to each other at this time.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting way of exploring topics like metaphor, which I read a lot of early 18th century, right now, the chapter I'm working on, early 18th century medical books. And for me, it's metaphors of the body and bodies and cosmos and all of that. And it just really invited me to open that space, I think, to think, what are these metaphors doing beyond just making visible and perhaps intelligible the work of medicine?
Yeah.
I think it's methodologically this work you're doing with the literary, the witnessing and literary as a technology can be very, very useful for people working on early modern knowledge categories and dealing with this literature that is so full of metaphor. And I thought that was very well captured. So you already mentioned this a little bit, but I was very interested in this idea that science is a trope. And I wanted you to explore this a little bit more.
Yeah. So, and it does, it kind of builds on what we were just discussing. So to my mind, it is incredibly powerful to think about the world being available to us through, for example, a microscope or through a poem.
Right.
And that these are ways of seeing. And seeing itself is both a physical and cognitive process. So if we take, as writers in the 17th and 18th century did, if we take this idea of science, and I do want to bracket, of course, the word science is anachronistic to the time. Natural philosophy is much more used. But I use the word science as a way to help us bridge the temporal
right.
disjunction. Right. So, but if we think of science itself, not in the way that it is now, kind of culturally accepted as a source of truth and just kind of the way things are. And I know I'm doing a broad caricature, and we can talk later about how even that broad caricature is coming under attack by other caricatures about how science is false. But if we really think about the scientific endeavor as an endeavor of making, of figuration, mm-hmm. then we can come to understand the sort of the knowledge claims that scientific practice depends upon, and the knowledge claims that writers who then use, in a sense, this new form of knowledge making, science, as an occasion to think about what literary knowledge is doing differently. So for me, that becomes, it's a way of deepening and ennobling what science actually is. In the 17th and 18th century. So it's a mode of figuration, which I know sounds very abstract, but it is a way of making things known, which has metaphorical connotations. And you have to, in a sense, be able to know differently. You have to be able to imagine differently. So, yeah. And that's one of the things that I really think, you know, just even to kind of segue into our contemporary discourse, I think that, you know, in the histories of objectivity, a lot of histories of science have been very uncomfortable with the role of the imagination. And you see that right from the beginning, that the imagination is dangerous. And I think one of the, in a sense, the dangers of ignoring that is that it becomes, you know, fact becomes more reliable than fiction. And it suggests a kind of neat division between the two that I think is impoverishes really how we understand the world around us and makes what we think of today as scientific learning. It leaves it vulnerable to the accusation that it's imaginative and therefore false. So I'm interested in recapturing the productive epistemological value of what the imagination produces.
Yeah, I when I was reading, I really thought about this problem as well, and especially when I TA mostly STEM students in history of medicine classes, and you know, we have built this divide, and it's almost the disciplines exist almost to enforce it, and yet there are all these efforts going on, be it in medical humanities or in trying to bridge the arts with STEM, that are actually just, I think, discovering what already was, what has always been there, was that this imaginative process, this metaphorical process, this way of thinking and figuration, like as you use it in metaphors, were always there. So I think it's actually something that the STEM fields are discovering a little bit. But I think, yeah, it feeds into our contemporary debates very, very much. So perhaps we can go a little bit into the book itself. We are already discussing, but so you start with this sentence that I really wanted you to discuss, because I find it very, what should I call it, subtly provocative, which is when your book's animating question, how literariness became or came to be distinguished from its epistemological sibling, science, as a source of truth about the natural world. So this idea of an epistemological sibling, I find very evocative and quite powerful. And I wanted to hear you speak a bit more about that.
Sure. And the language of family ultimately is a way, you know, siblings is a way of making visible really what disciplines are. That disciplines operate individually, but also collectively, as ways of knowing the world and ways of understanding the world. And the ways that the difference between literature and science have really often been imagined, even though, as I say, we know factually, we know historically that they were not distinguished. But looking back at the archive, we already distinguished them. And in distinguishing them, we put them into hierarchy. So what I wanted, the language of siblinghood and an epistemological sibling, is really to insist that there is knowledge production in the act of reading and interpreting literature. That this is not, literature operates on a number of realms. It has affect, it produces affect in the reader. But it also produces insight. So what is that that one knows from reading a literary text that one cannot know from reading an economic text or reading a text about microscopy? And the modern university, the kind of ideal civic institution of the university, to my mind, and it's the practical aspect of this is not evident, but it isn't evident. But the ideal is really where you have these plural approaches to plural objects that suggest where we, you know, what our life is in the world. And in this way, I'm thinking a little bit about Jonathan Cramnick's new book, Paper Minds, in which he makes this argument about the value of disciplinary thinking, that it is not, you know, it isn't one at the expense of another. And, you know, my own institution, the University of Maryland, the president has been quoted many times about talking with this, with a really peculiar metaphor. He's quoted in the Washington Post that the university is STEM, and at the top of that STEM is the flower of humanities. and you know, but then asked, would you hire a Victorian poetry professor over an engineering professor? I believe that was the specific question. He said, oh, no, absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
So there, I am not naive in that the modern educational system, the ideal is we are very, very far from the ideal. But conceptually and theoretically and historically, I think it's extremely important to think about literary knowledge, which is why I use the term literary knowledge rather than literature or literariness. And that's one of the key words that I use to frame. So it's literary knowledge and science. And in a sense, that word knowledge is really in there for us today, right? That, you know, we're not just sitting around talking about, you know, what this poem made me think about. That there is a, I mean, which is wonderful in its own way, but there is rigor and praxis and practice and strong good readings, and there are bad readings. As I tell my students all the time, we all have bad readings. We just want to make sure we learn the difference between good and bad readings.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So maybe we can go into chapter one. And we've already touched on this a little bit, but I wanted you to explore more the idea of the modest witness. And you have also you state at a certain point that scientific knowledge requires literary knowledge but suppresses it simultaneously. So I wanted to consider these two ideas in dialogue.
Okay. The modest witness I have found to be intellectually very exciting. The concept from Leviathan and Air Pump, I think, opens up what this early material, you know, with Boyle and Hooke can really do. And it is fascinating to track, to me, how, and in the book I talk about Boyle and Hooke really construct, they manufacture what this modest witness is. And it is, you know, in Boyle's instance, the modest witness has no physical presence, which is a fascinating description of what an experiment is. The experiment is all about the instrument. Of course, the instrument has to be, you know, doesn't work on its own. It doesn't have its own animation. So the modest witness physically really gets written out. And then with Hooke, he uses metonymy. It's hand and eye. So that's all you get from the modest witness. So on the one hand, the category of modest witness, which I see really, you know, absolutely crucial to notions of scientific objectivity and this idea of neutrality, it requires that the practitioner be invisible.
Right.
But it also requires that the practitioner be there. So it has to have two, you know, those things have to happen at the same time. And driving, you know, kind of the wedge that I want to call into this is, you know, and Donna Haraway made this point long before I did, that this notion of the kind of unperceived and self-effacing observer is absolutely gendered, absolutely ranked, and absolutely classed. So it's a world in which the only individual who can be beyond bias is the individual who has everything. And that is really at odds, I think, with contemporary notions of what objectivity can and should be. So, this idea of objectivity as really being a kind of benefit or feature of privilege is something that my analysis of A Modest Witness, I hope, really reveals. And that's why I use that language then of the immodest witness. So what does the immodest witness tell us about the modest witness? So that's the scientific practitioner who can only see him or herself in experimental learning, who is not beyond subjective bias. And this can be both for productive ends, like in the case of the Bassett table and the young woman, or it's completely delusional and self-interested and destructive, as in the case of Shadwell's The Virtuoso. So it's that doubleness of both requiring but then suppressing the role of this kind of privileged individual that I find was necessary, and quote unquote necessary, for early scientific defenses, but has instituted a legacy that raises a bunch of other problems.
And particularly raises these gendered and class-based issues that you bring out. And maybe we can then, as you've already alluded to the immodest witness, talk about the antagonist of the modest, which is these two main figures that you explore throughout the second chapter. The gimcrack and the coquette.
Yes. And
they are these embodiments of everything that objectivity isn't.
Right. And they really are, and kind of hilariously so in lots of ways. I mean, we meet gimcrack. He's learning how to swim by, watching a frog and imitating a frog's motion while he's on a table. So, he collects jars of air. Kind of direct parodies of the kind of work that was available in the Philosophical Transactions. So a lot of kind of attention to these ridiculous scientists, these immodest witnesses, have kind of fallen into the assessment of, it's not that science was really ridiculed, it's that these were bad scientists. And I wanted I really wanted to take the immodest witnesses on their own terms, which is to say, I wanted to think about, beyond the kind of ridiculousness, what is this satiric work doing? And this is one of the ways in which my training as a literary scholar and the work that I did in my first book, half of which was devoted to satire, really came to help me unpack and understand that, particularly by these being satires, there's there's an edge of critique that is going after the scientific project altogether. In terms of contemporary science studies, I was also very intrigued by Natasha Meyer's work on embodiment in the laboratory, in the contemporary laboratory. And she's talking about protein modeling and how the practitioners and the scientists themselves really use their bodies to learn and to imagine protein modeling. So taking that, and that's a book that came out with Duke a couple of years ago, but taking that as a way to think about the benefit of subjectivity over objectivity allow me then to revisit these character types who show up all over the 18th century corpus. So I selected just a few, but gimcracks are there's a long, long afterlife. And coquettes, there's a long, long afterlife. So the gimcrack, I was most interested in how that figure, and in The Virtuoso, he's a rich man who ends up being humiliated sexually and financially, but never really kind of learns his lessons. But then that same term gets applied to two different women, and how that critique is much more savage. So a character, Lady Science, in James Miller's play called Oxford Humours, she's a powerful widow. Her dialogue is very, very funny. She speaks everything through scientific metaphor and all kind of jumbled, like, you know, there's nothing there. And she, you know, is obstructive in all the ways that guardians tend to be in dramas. She controls the purse strings. She's going to decide who can court her daughter. By the end, she's absolutely humiliated and has to renounce everything, including her access to science. So one of the differences between Shadwell's treatment of his gimcrack and Miller's treatment of his with Lady Science is that with the virtuoso, the science is kind of ridiculous, but it's mostly because it's done by this particular man in who's deluded and, you know, and ridiculous. In the Humours of Oxford, science isn't the problem. Science is legitimate. Problem is a woman doing it. And so that I found a very sobering contrast. And that gets to, you know, you alluded a little while ago about the feminist commitments of this book. And by attending to the ways in which gender is manufactured and policed and regulated through the practice of science, I not only open up our archive, but come to show how science as a metaphor facilitates the, you know, in some ways, some very conservative ideas about gender emerging, particularly by humiliating a widow. You know, a widow is one of the most powerful sorts of women to be because she has, I always tell my students, you know, you're just waiting for your husband to die and then you get all the money and you don't have to answer to anyone. It's sort of the best thing, right? And in this particular, in Miller's play, her power is completely taken away. And I can't underscore enough the kind of humiliation. So it's a total humiliation in a way that it is, you know, so science is fine, but it's who does it and who gets regulated. So my feminist commitment really extends to gender and class. And there's more work that needs to be done on race and empire as well.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I was very struck by this statement you make at the end that ultimately the gimcrack and the coquette become the avatars of enlightenment. And I wanted you to hear, I wanted to hear a bit more about that as well.
Yeah. So it's the, and the coquette in a sense is the more radical case to be made. Because as I, you know, as I said, the coquette shows up, is a ubiquitous quote unquote problem in 17th and 18th century literature. in no small part because a coquette is so she's an unmarried woman, so she doesn't have access to her mm-hmm. money, but a coquette refuses to accede to the pressures of the marriage market. The coquette mm-hmm. holds on to that moment, that one moment when a young woman has choice. And a coquette is often presented as an epistemological problem. How do you know what she wants? Because you can't tell. You can't read her.
Right.
And so there are lots of poems and plays and novels where, her inscrutability raises questions and concerns about interpretation and dissection, quite literally. And so then the periodicals, The Spectator and The Female Spectator, really gravitate towards thinking through what a coquette can and cannot be. And so on the one hand, a coquette is a denigrated category, in the hands of Addison and Steele. Yes, you can't read her, but we all know. It's like the dressing room poem all over again. Mm-hmm. If we dissect her heart, we can see that she was pining for the guy all along, and she just was kind of selfishly forestalling the kind of contours and movement of the marriage market just for her own self-indulgence. And that's a very conservative view. But the radical view that I promote in the book is that the coquette and the gimcrack in the character Valeria in The Basset Table, and so it's Eliza Haywood's coquette, the two of them suggest a model of subjecthood that we can trace to the protein modeling that mm-hmm. Myers discusses in the contemporary laboratory. And so being present and being a self in the process of producing knowledge is in those ways superior to the manufactured idea of objectivity, which in the hands of, in the satires is not objective and just leads to stupidity and inconsequence. So I'm as a long-term mm-hmm. feminist scholar of the Enlightenment, I'm very interested in the moments that the larger history tend to write out, that we see these moments of kind of progressive possibility that may or may mm-hmm. not get picked up. But I think it's very important to think about Enlightenment thinking and knowledge structures not as uniform, but as holding open certain kinds of more radical spaces. And I think that's also why I stand behind a much wider archive. You find these right. moments mm-hmm. by looking beyond the kind of authorized texts. So that's where my training as a literary scholar really comes in, that I can find these sorts of scientific moments way outside the philosophical transactions.
Right. And I think there's something in this idea of avatar of enlightenment, and you unpacked it, I think, very beautifully right now. But there's something about being a subject and about refusing, especially when you are gendered or racialized, refusing to follow the prescribed social roles. And so if you have a woman who is not marrying, that is actually very subversive to the social political order.
It is. It's very. And that's, and that leads to, within the status quo, that leads to denigration and satire and ridicule, trying to take away her power, trying right. to humiliate. Mm-hmm. And so that's another kind of reason I want to hold these moments up. I want to hold them. Yes, women could not own property in the 18th century. The 18th century, British wealth was born on the back of the trafficking of Africans, enslaved right. into mm-hmm. the world. Absolutely all of this. Within this context, those moments of resistance and those moments of subversion, I think, can give us very powerful histories looking forward and looking, understanding social change, political change today. And the value of, and I'm using that phrase of holding up, of not going to the kind of later 18th, not letting the later 18th century story of what comes to be really enforce how we understand what's happening in the 1740s is a key part of understanding that not only did these categories emerge fitfully, but in conflict with each other, and that there are real places and moments of intellectual, aesthetic, and political resistance that are that were available, and how to, you know, what more can we do with those moments?
Right. So perhaps let's move into chapter three, and from immodesty to seduction.
Yes.
I like the sequence of chapters is actually a narrative unto itself. But I actually think this chapter would be very well paired with Kuhn and thinking about paradigms. Mm-hmm. And in particular, because you challenge this idea of rationality. And in fact, you state that truth in natural philosophy was a seductive affair. And so I'd like to hear more about that. And what are the essential components of seduction that go into these, be it in terms of power relations, desire, sexual, or desire for knowledge, or affect?
Okay. In modesty to seduction, right? You understand the book. Yeah. So this chapter emerged from, you know, yet more of those kind of eureka moments. And it came from reading a Haywood novel, Love in Excess, where this idealized and idealized heroine, who is very interesting because she is positively rendered throughout, and she has sexual desire, which is unusual by the time you get to the mid-century. So this is earlier.
Right.
One of the ways that her quality is imagined is through her reading material, which is Fontenelle. And it precipitates a moment of seduction within the novel. So I was, that's what really got me into thinking about, you know, what on earth is science doing, you know, Cartesian science doing in a seduction novel? And that then got me to really to think about how seduction itself is a paradigm of pedagogy, and that it is a way of acquiring something. In this case, knowledge. So with the Fontenelle and the Algarotti, they both play so exquisitely on the balance or the interrelationship, the intimacy between sexual seduction and knowledge seduction, that it seemed to me that there's much more going on than just a kind of incidental, offhand use of a seduction plot. So it in both of them, and they're interesting texts too, because the way that they're consumed in Britain is, I mean, in their originals, of course, but also through translation by two of the most formidable women thinking and writing, and that is Aphra Behn and Elizabeth Carter. So this idea that one has finally to assent to believe any, you know, the kind of scientific thinking that's promoted as Cartesian or Newtonian, it's a very powerful way of understanding, as you say, or recalibrating really what rationality is. And we see this today. I mean, there are articles all the time. Why aren't people convinced by facts, right?
Right.
if only they knew,
Right.
Well, they do know, but they, you know. And so I think...
Sort of the idea that education in and of itself will solve every problem.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you, you know, let's just get the right information out there and people,
right,
and people
exactly.
will agree. Mm-hmm. So I think what these early writers are really attuned to is the inadequacy of that rationalist argument. And so the fact that both of them make this analogy between mathematicians and lovers is very purposeful. And it is also a way of opening up the subjecthood of who can practice and who can engage in scientific thinking well beyond the mm-hmm. modest witness that Boyle and
right.
Hooke imagined
mm-hmm.
and their contemporaries. You know, mathematicians are just like lovers. They take you so far and then you just, you know, and then you just jump. So it's, you know, and both Fontenelle and Algarotti, I think also to varying degrees, make that seductive process not only one of, you know, a male desiring individual over a female,
mm-hmm.
But that the scientists, the male tutors in both of these dialogues become seduced by the women they're training,
mm-hmm.
as well as the idea of science altogether. So the pairing in the dialogue, and the dialogue itself is a genre that destabilizes. The pairing is of an aristocratic woman with a male tutor who's below her in rank. And that distinction also helps unsettle our kind of tired understanding of gender hierarchy and also mm-hmm. class hierarchy. It's, you know, it's a different world in the 18th century. It's a very different world. But I think that becomes very purposeful.
Right. And it's so interesting, and especially sort of maybe actually moving to chapter four, just I really appreciated how you linked this sort of this subjective dimension of seduction, and then you expanded that scale to a much broader political scale of seduction, and you call it the political science.
Yeah.
So here you read Cavendish and Spratt and Swift, and through these readings you demonstrate that the epistemological work of natural philosophy could not be separated from the political institutions that actually allowed it to flourish. And you put it actually very succinctly that ways of knowing are bound up with ways of governing, which, at least to my work, is also a very central insight. So I wanted to hear more about this, of seduction on this collective level.
Yeah, thank you. And part of that, you know, my work in this is absolutely indebted to Latour's reading mm-hmm. of Chapin and Schaeffer. And,
right.
You know, and his playing out what Chapin and Schaeffer's reading of Boyle and Hobbes really obscures, that political is always scientific and science is always political. The critiques of Latour are well established and I think important. Sandra Harding, in particular,
mm-hmm.
did a very efficient job of noting, you know, in the We Have Never Been Modern, you know, who's we?
The eternal question.
Who is we? You know, is we that nice, you know, modest witness? So for me, what became this conversation in science studies opened up key ways of understanding really what Spratt in his history, very early history of the Royal Society, is trying
mm-hmm.
to accomplish, and really to begin to deal with the, in Cavendish, the from a modern point of view, the very unappealing, unsettling politics of her fictional scientific imagination. And also to take very seriously the genocidal effects of science in Gulliver's Travels. So there is, not only am I interested in the kind of scaling, as you say, kind of scaling up to thinking about what kinds of political communities are possible, but also to say that there's an ethics that runs through the science and political always. So someone like Spratt, he's writing in the white light of having just been through a civil war. And to read him generously and give him the benefit of the doubt, he sees the Royal Society's promotion of experimental and natural philosophy as a key mechanism of civil society. It allows people to disagree without killing each other. And if you set, you know, it's, again, he wrote it very early, and it was clearly propaganda to promote this very fledgling society. But there's something very idealistic and very hopeful about that, of how do we shape civil discourse. And and in a sense, I think Spratt hasn't been that gravitas, that very serious element of his work, I don't think has really gotten enough attention and a kind of valuation for that in and of itself. He's easy to critique in a certain way. But this aspect, I think, is a, it speaks to the, what, quote unquote, the Enlightenment can do, the kind of possibility that is still there. It gets perverted at every turn and rarely becomes realized. But there is that kind of germ of possibility. And then someone like Cavendish, she wants, you know, absolutism is the way to go.
Right.
You know, and I find teaching the Blazing World very fascinating for all sorts of reasons. The students immediately recognize the kind of the essentialized scientific characters. But they're today, in you know, today's U.S. context, they're very uncomfortable with her absolutism. And I think, you know, rightfully so. And it is, they cannot put together and understand that on the one hand, she wants a woman leading. But simultaneously, so it seems to them, you know, they have the language of feminism.
So it seems progressive on the one
hand. Exactly, very progressive. And yet, this very traditional, almost authoritarian model of politics. And so that also gets at gender and rank and gender and class. That, you know, so many of the most, quote unquote, progressive radical thinkers in the late 17th century were in fact royalists. Exactly. And you say that
to hence the need for intersectionality.
Exactly. And you know, you talk that to, you know, tell that to a junior at the University of Maryland, and she or he who's just come from some protest, like, you've got to be, you know, you're kidding. And then the last thing I'll say is that I wanted a way to talk about Gulliver's Travels that really brought something to the table. You know, in the studies of literature and science in the 18th century, Gulliver's Travels is the, you know, it's the text, it's the go-to text. It's the place where we can see that Swift himself is so skeptical about science and transcribes, you know, extracts from Philosophical Transactions. And that is another place that was an occasion for me to really take my my deep engagement with satire and ask, really, what are the implications here? And what is this beyond, you know, laughing at scientists who want to turn, you know, excrement back into food? And that is really, and really, what is the relationship between this entire kind of world that's designed to make fun of scientific thinking and then the absolutely, utterly dystopian world of the talking horses, the Whitams, and their desire to murder the Yahoos, right? I mean, they just, this hyper-rationalistic horse world, quote-unquote, reasonably debates genocide. And, you know, how do we get from one to the next.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so I think Swift offers a very, very key lesson that, you know, instrumental thinking, which he sees mm-hmm. as coming out of scientific thinking without ethics, is immoral. It's fundamentally mm-hmm. immoral. Yeah.
Right. And I just wanted to emphasize for listeners that in this chapter, you also, in addition to describing this these debates, these very important debates about knowledge and the political order, you also emphasize very much the role of the imagination, not only in terms of the practice of natural philosophy, but as a factor that enables the formation of like-minded communities and that allows the formation of new knowledge. So I wanted to take this insight and move to the last chapter, which is on poetry and the role of aesthetics. And my question here is quite simple. I mostly would like to hear you speak more about how does aesthetics mediate the promise of natural philosophy? And what sort of epistemologies does aesthetics entail? And how do these epistemologies feed into the title of the book, into the experimental imagination?
Thanks. And it does. I mean, the overall arc of the book is to kind of get to this final chapter. In the writing of it, I had it in the middle of the manuscript at one point. And I realized that this to tell the story, it really needed to come at the end. And so the story ultimately is that that literary knowledge uses the occasion of science to think through its own protocols as a form of epistemology. Simultaneously, aesthetics, which is the study of art, begins to emerge. It's another one of those siblings. To emerge in the 18th century, and mm-hmm. it relies upon a similar set of imagined protocols about observation, perception, and truth, similar protocols mm-hmm. to scientific thinking. So looking at the aesthetic writing, for example, of Shaftesbury, you can see that this idea of the distance observer, the observer who does not want to own. So that's often a sign of neutrality. Although, of course, mm-hmm. the distance observer doesn't want to own because he already owns. So that's a whole other thing. But that it's the category of aesthetics itself draws and elaborates this idea of the kind modest witness and the minute particular, the kind of thing. But to the end of producing aesthetic categories, so ideas about art and what art tells mm-hmm. us about the world. So if we go back to my earlier observations about what disciplinarity fundamentally does, is that these are ways of knowing the world around us. And mm-hmm, right. and they all have different objects, and they all have different modes. So aesthetics is interested in the production of art. So for me, right. the term mediation becomes very important in the final chapter, that the poems I discuss, so by one extremely famous poet, Alexander Pope, one a little bit less so, James Thompson, and then a bunch of poems that are mainly anonymous. So that's running the gamut of poems published in periodicals to poems that are still taught today in any British literature survey, that these become occasions for what I call aesthetic mediations of science. So what does it look like when the occasion of science is turned into a poem? So mm-hmm. particularly with James Thompson's poem, The Seasons, where he has a wonderful, disturbing moment where a viewer, the viewer in the novel, it's funny, I called it a novel. It's so descriptive, it seems like a novel. In the poem, looks through a microscope, fears falling in, and starts hearing noise. It's overwhelmed by noise. And this idea that there is no boundary between who you are and what you see is not unique to Thompson's poetry. There are concerns about, you know, in the development of microscopy that, you know, what you're somehow what you're looking at is going to look back at you. There are wonderful moments of early scientists using a fly's eye to one in particular, Leon Hook, using a fly's eye mm-hmm. to look at a church steeple. So mm-hmm. it's not a microscope, but it's a thing that's only available because you have a microscope and you're looking through someone else's eye. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, many layers of mediation. And what I wanted to really, in a sense, hold up is how in Thompson, the image and logic of the prism allows for a way of seeing the world that is beyond its technological possibility. So prism breaks down, of course, you know, what light is. But in Thompson's imaginings of the Newtonian prism, it becomes a way of perceiving difference that is not visible to the naked or even to the optically aided eye. And so that's where aesthetics really can do and produce insights that scientific thinking alone cannot.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. And in actually going back to poetry, a lot of my texts start with poems, especially early 18th century texts.
Really?
And made me look at those poems in a whole different light just to think about the possibilities contained therein. So Tita, I think we've taken quite a few of your time now, quite a bit of your time, but I'd like to know if there's anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to discuss, or what else are you working on at the moment?
Oh, thank you. I mean, as someone who, you know, you work for years on something, and so the chance to talk about it is such a delight. So thank you for your wonderful questions and for spurring such a really generative conversation. One quick thing and then a larger thing. So I'm not surprised that you say, you know, a lot of the texts that you look at begin with poetry. Henry Baker, a fellow of the Royal Society, he published a lot of scientific texts. He also published a lot of poetry. So even in the textual productions of these players, there wasn't the disciplinary distinction. You know, my colleagues in biology are not writing and publishing poetry. I mean, maybe.
They don't write dialogues?
Yeah. They're not writing dialogues, not writing plays, not, you know, and I'm not writing it's a whole other thing. So that would...
I have to say some of my favorite texts are dialogues, and they're extremely amusing and funny.
They are really, I know, yes, exactly, because it really puts you there very much in the moment. So I would say that writing the experimental imagination and seeing it out in the world was both concluded a lot of thinking that I've been doing for about a decade, but also instigated new thinking. And so right now I'm working on a new project that takes up wonder as a way of really understanding even more in a different register, the relationship between literature and science. So it's, one of the questions I'm thinking about is, and it links with today, that, how is it that knowing is often described as a feeling? What mm-hmm.
Right.
I just know.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of wonder as a feeling, but also as a way of knowing itself. So I'm in the early stages yet, but it's that part has been really... working on the wonder is very productive. And one of the other things that bringing this work out into the world has given me the chance to do is for 3 years I'll be doing a the year's work essay on science and medical studies for the journal year's work in critical and cultural theory, I think is what it's called. My apologies. Mm-hmm. But that is, and so the fall, the official version will come out, but it has given me an opportunity to read very widely in science studies and to think about these kind of larger questions about concerning decolonization, embodiment, mm-hmm. what the archive is, what and who the scientist is, more broadly. So that's what the experimental imagination has made possible for me in the short and near term. And after that, we'll see. I'll probably finish this next book and then find another text which would have changed how I wrote it. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And it starts all over again.
I do have to say that an old friend and mentor of mine, Randy Trumbach, Professor Randolph Trumbach, he's at the CUNY Graduate School. I was a, you know, bright-eyed graduate student and mm-hmm. wrote him a letter saying this is what I was working on, and I was living in the city, and you know, could I come by his office hours? And we went to lunch and finished, you know, 4 hours later. During that time, he said to me, you know, he listened to my dissertation, and he said, "You have ideas for a career." He said, "That's what, you know, it's as though you have one set of ideas that keep finding a new home." So I always think of that moment very fondly. It's a very generous response to a, you know, very eager, you know, trying to figure out what my dissertation was.
Yeah, and telling you very politely, pace yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, and he's still a very good friend. Yeah.
Well, Tita, thank you very much for this conversation. And you must let me know when these things come out. They sound like really something I need to read.
Thank you, Patricia. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. And I really appreciate your generosity, your intellectual generosity, and the generosity of this podcast. Thank you you do this for all of us, and for me in particular today, but for all of us. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very much welcome.